See, we have a Gilbraith with us. I hope I don't say anything too far off the mark.
Good morning. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome. Mike, do you now feel like the teacher's in the room?
Yes.
My dad was John, the number 10 of the 12.
Wow. Well, I'm glad you've joined us today. Should be an interesting conversation. I am excited to see you all. It's been a while. It was early December that we were last together, and I've really missed these programs. And so I'm delighted to have you all back. We now have a whole slate of programs coming up through May, and I hope to finish it up through June at least. And so keep an eye on that. We've got everything. We've got architecture. We've got Olmsted. We've got all sorts of really interesting topics coming up this spring. So hope you join us on more of them. As you know, these can all are all found on YouTube. After a couple of weeks, it takes me a while to get them up there, but you can find them on YouTube. And Carol, I don't believe the two from the library are on YouTube. They were not my program, so I don't know. You might have to reach out to the public library to find out the answer to that question. And I'm going to stop right here and ask Mike to take over from me, because Mike is our town historian, and he is a member of our board of trustees. And Mike is a wealth of information about all things Montclair history. And I'm excited that he's going to be putting this presentation up so that we can get it on YouTube, because I know the Gilbreth family is always a source of, we always get questions about the family. And so I'm happy to welcome one of them actually here with us today, Peter, who is the grandson of Lillian and Frank Gilbreth. So delighted to have you with us. And Mike, you can take it away and start sharing your screen.
Okay. We're going to talk about Frank and Lillian Gilbreth. I have to start with a disclaimer, because I stole some slides from somebody else's slideshow for the beginning of this. I couldn't find the pictures anywhere else, so I stole these slides, and I apologize to whoever wrote this presentation. Frank grew up in the Boston area, and decided not to go to MIT, but decided to work in the construction trades. Instead, he became very much interested in the ideas of Frederick Taylor, who was a pioneer in time and motion studies. And Frank started to apply some of these principles to his own construction company. Lillian, well, I almost hesitate to talk about Lillian, because whenever I do, I can't believe how much she accomplished in her life. And I think I joked about it when I gave this first presentation the first time, that every time you talk about Lillian, you come away feeling like an underachiever compared to her. She grew up in Oakland, and her parents did not want her to go away to school, but she finally convinced them to let her go to University of California in Berkeley. She graduated with a degree in English literature and then went on to a PhD program in psychology. Now, in 1903, her family wanted her to go to Europe. And at that time, a young lady would not go to Europe unaccompanied. So she was chaperoned by Frank's, just by coincidence, she was chaperoned by Frank's cousin. And she came to meet Frank, and she fell in love with him. Now, I apologized for stealing slides from that presentation. I had this slide, but the picture of Frank was pretty fuzzy. So I went out on the internet just before I gave this presentation and found the same slide again, but look at the format, it's different. So I am not the only person who stole from that original slide presentation. Anyway, Frank had his construction company. He decided the first thing he, first project he undertook was to study bricklaying. At the day, at the time, the average bricklayer, you could used to lay about 1,000 bricks a day. After his studies, Frank was able to get his bricklayers to lay over 2,000 bricks a day. And he did this by reducing the motions from 18 to 4. I think, I am not positive, I think that is Frank in that picture. Here, studying how his guys were putting the bricks together. He wrote a book, of course. He wrote several books throughout his life. If you can see in the picture on the right, the way bricklayers used to lay bricks was involved a lot of bending over and a lot of wasted motion and a lot of fatigue. What Frank brought to the party was a new system where everything was laid out very carefully for the bricklayers so that they could do their job much more efficiently with a lot less steps. Primarily, he invented a new scaffolding system. This is a picture of it here on the left. And here's a kind of, unfortunately, I couldn't get a better picture of this. Picture of the same scaffold. You know, we're talking about 1904 here, so the photography was not always great. 1904, 1905, not always the best. This is the patent, the picture for the patent that he applied for. And what happened here is the laborer who was bringing the bricks up the ladder could stand on the bottom platform and then place the bricks carefully so that they will all be the right in the right orientation when the bricklayer actually got to them. He would place it on the top platform. The bricklayer would stand in the middle platform, and then he would have less, he wouldn't have to bend over so much. He could much more easily place the bricks on the wall he was building. And here is just another contemporary picture. Not the best, not the best quality. Couldn't find a better quality picture. Frank's business really took off when he built this building for MIT. He built this building using his techniques he had developed and built it in unbelievable record time, way ahead of schedule. And this really launched Frank's business. Now, Frank also became more interested in the time and motion portion of the business. He kind of stepped back a little bit from construction and started to get more seriously involved in time and motion study. And what he would do, and Lillian joined him, is they would put lights on study subjects. So, and they would put a, you can see here in the background, there's a graph. And they would do time-lapse photography, and they could actually see the motions that a person went through in order to achieve whatever. Well, they, you know, they study all kinds of things from cooking to typewriting to, you know, building. They studied motion in a variety of fields. And this is kind of what the finished picture would look like. This is called, what do they call it? Yeah, light, No, it doesn't matter. Oh, photo painting is what they called it. Do not know what this subject is doing, but you can see the same technique where they can follow the lights. The grid marks allowed the Gilbreths to see if there was any overreach or wasted motion. That Fred Taylor, when he developed the science of time and motion study, very interested in reducing the number of steps a worker would do to accomplish something in order to speed up the process. And that was very much for the benefit of the company that hired Fred. The Gilbreths also wanted to reduce the number of steps that a person took, but they were much more concerned about using each step more efficiently. What they were really interested in doing was trying to eliminate waste and fatigue. Unlike Fred, who just wanted to reduce steps, they wanted to improve the process and improve the tools that were being used to make it easier for the person to do the job. I told you they actually went to study typewriting, and you can see in the background a clock, a special clock that they made for this time-lapse photography. It says Gilbreth on it. Here is another subject, typing, but using the Gilbreth clocks and the grid system so that they could really study each individual motion that the person made. Just some pictures of Frank in his office. He passed away. He was on a trip to New York. He passed away. We walked from their home down to the Lackawanna station on Bloomfield Avenue and Grove Street. He got an idea, and he went into a phone booth to call Lillian. He had an idea. They were working for Lever Brothers at the time. And he had an idea, and he started to tell Lillian the idea and just stopped. Lillian heard a thump, and then a few minutes later, the operator came on and said, "Well, the party you were speaking to has just hung up. Frank had a heart attack and passed away. He was scheduled to go to Europe a couple days later." Lillian had to honor that commitment. Part of their motion study involved, they developed a system of symbols to represent each possible step in every activity. They called them Thurblegs, and which was an actual play on the Gilbreth name. If you played a little bit around with it, and reverse this portion of their name, you come up with Thurblegs. Lillian, I told you that she went on to a doctorate degree, a doctorate program at the University of California at Berkeley. Because she met Frank and they married in 1904, she moved to the New York area. Well, first the Boston area and then to the New York area. Even though she had completed all the work, her dissertation, she had defended her dissertation, she completed all the work for a doctorate in psychology, the university refused to grant it to her because she no longer lived in the state of California. So, no problem. She went to Brown and took a whole new doctoral program in the field of business, science of management, which she was becoming interested in anyway. She was involved in many, many projects during her life, but she became famous for her work in designing kitchens. In 1929, shortly after Frank passed away, she got involved in a project called the Kitchen Practical. Now, up until a couple of days ago, I thought Lillian had invented the whole concept of the kitchen triangle. I don't know if you guys have heard of it. It's where the stove, the refrigerator, and the sink are supposed to be in a triangle and no more than 21 feet away from each other. And that is supposed to help reduce the number of steps involved in cooking. Well, actually, Lillian wanted things closer than that. If you can see this diagram here, this is how she wanted her kitchen to be. She wanted everything to be basically within reach. And she was very big on the use of rolling tables to help with cooking, so that everything you needed to prepare and all the two utensils you were going to use to prepare it with were right there within reach of the refrigerator and the stove. And this is just a picture of her design, the Kitchen Practical. Again, Lillian, well, both Frank and Lillian were more concerned about designing equipment and designing the process to make it more efficient for a worker. Lillian got involved with designing stuff for handicapped people. The Navy had a project in 1944. Was called Normal Lives for the Disabled. Lillian became very involved with that. So she started designing things to help disabled people accomplish normal tasks. Actually, her ideas about cooking did not sit well with kitchen manufacturers. You know, people who made kitchen cabinets, people who made kitchen appliances. Lillian wanted to customize everything so that it would fit the capabilities of the cook. If the cook was small, she wanted the counters to be small. She wanted to be everything, you know, make it easy for a smaller person to do the job. If the cook was tall, she wanted everything to be customized to be tall. And make it easier for the person to reach everything. Well, kitchen appliance manufacturers and kitchen manufacturers didn't really like that idea. They wanted to standardize everything. So her ideas about cooking did not really take hold. They weren't really popular with the kitchen manufacturers, you know, and appliance manufacturers. But her ideas about helping the handicapped have really influenced the science of helping the handicapped people. And we're getting back to the photo painting. This is just a picture of a guy cooking goulash and the steps involved. Again, a picture of Lillian. At first, Lillian took over Frank's business. Well, their business. It wasn't Frank's business. She joined. She was his partner. He passed away. She took over the business. And at first, she was not getting a lot of jobs because she was a woman, and this was considered a man's field. She was considering giving up the ghost, because she had this huge family to watch, and she couldn't make the journeys out to visit all her clients. So she started a school where she could pass her ideas on along to clients and businesses. And she was considering giving up the ghost she basically set up the school. And she wanted to see who was going to join. if there were less than six people who came to study with her, it was a failure. She was not going to be able to continue going on to the business. And her goal was to raise enough money to send her kids to college. Fortunately for her, after several weeks of agonizing weeks of hand-wringing and waiting for clients to show up, fortunately, at the last minute, eight people showed up, and that made her school a success. In time, she started to win over companies, clients. She started to win over male associates. She became a professor. She taught the science of management at several colleges. This is a picture of her at Purdue. She wrote or co-wrote dozens of books. Remember what I said about this lady being an overachiever and me being an underachiever? You know, she was amazing because she did all this while raising a gigantic family and being a very good mom to every one of her kids. She was very active in Girl Scouts, and she was later invited to the White House. Mrs. Hoover, the first lady, Lou Henry Hoover, was also very active in Girl Scouts, and she invited Lillian to the White House. Another picture of her. This is, okay. In time, Lillian was not only accepted by her male colleagues, but she was honored by them. She is shown here accepting the Hoover Award. Now, this was named after Hoover. This was not initiated by Herbert Hoover, who had been an engineer at one point in his life. The Hoover Award is it's not given out often. It's rarely given out because it is jointly awarded by five separate engineering associations. So it is really an honor to receive the Hoover Award. And here she is receiving it. She was the first woman ever to be placed in the National Academy of Engineering Hall of Fame. Here she is christening Gilbraith Hall, which is the math and science building at the Rhode Island University. In her lifetime, she was awarded 28 honorary doctorate degrees. Her work impressed a lot of people. And in 1984, the US Post Office issued a stamp in her honor. When Frank and Lillian were first married, they lived in the Boston area. Around 1910, they came to the New York area and they lived in Plainfield. This is the house that they lived in Plainfield. At that time, she had eight kids. Unfortunately, one of the kids, Mary, died from diphtheria when she was only six. In 1916, maybe a little bit later, it was towards the end of the year, they moved to Montclair. And this is their house in Montclair. Well, maybe, maybe not. I think this is actually the house where Cheaper by the Dozen was filmed. That house was on the back lot of the studio. And here is the same house in Meet Me, it was used in the film Meet Me in St. Louis. So this is a picture of their actual house in Montclair. It no longer exists. It has been knocked down. It was 63 Eagle Rock Way. And here's another picture of it. As I said, the original house is gone. The street numbers changed, the lots changed. There is a new house standing on the spot where the old house was. It is now 108 Eagle Rock Way. However, if you look real closely, the carriage house from their original home still exists. The carriage house was where they did most of their photography. This is their car, a 1914 Pierce Arrow called Foolish Carriage. They couldn't afford a new car, so they got a used one. It was a bit of a clunker, but it got them around. And here is a picture. And again, those of you with keen eyes can see there's actually only 11 children because Mary had passed away. Another shot of the kids, except for Anne. They had a summer home in Nantucket, and they called it the Shoe. And Frank called it that because it reminded him of the poem. There was an old woman who lived in a shoe who had so many children she didn't know what to do. This is the Shoe. It had been a lighthouse station. This is the picture of it before they owned it. In Nantucket, they had a system where they had two lighthouses. One was smaller, one was larger. The first one had a white light, then behind it, closer to the harbor entrance, they had a bigger one with a red light. And this was set up so that ships coming in at night knew they were going in the right direction towards the harbor entrance. The Gilbraiths bought the house. They moved the two lighthouses a little bit closer together, and they moved the tool shed in between them. And here is a picture of them on a seesaw in front of the tool shed and the two lighthouses. Frank had a wonderful habit. He loved to line the kids up in order of height. He also assigned numbers to the kids. I guess this helped him remember who was who. And this is pretty much them in order of height. Girls against the boys. She had six girls, six boys. And this is all them all in front of the smaller lighthouse. Anne was the oldest. She was always left in charge whenever the parents left. Once she got to be old enough to be in charge. Frank's mom often would help out with, she would stay with Frank and Lillian and help with the kids. And they had adult servants. She married Dr. Barney. They called him Dr. Bob. And she lived in California. This is a picture of Mary, the one who died young. Ernestine, the second oldest, went to Smith. She was kind of the organizer of many. She was kind of the organizer of many of their events. She was very good at typing. They had a typewriter called Moby Dick, and she could type by touch very quickly, even with blank keys. She didn't have to look at the keys. She knew just by feel what she was typing. She did not get along real well with their manservant, Tom, and he figures prominently in both of the books about the Gilbert kids. Tom Greaves, his name was. He called her the princess, sometimes a little sarcastically. And it was basically Ernestine who, what happened after their father died, they had a cook, Mrs. Cunningham. They had to tighten their belts when dad died. There just wasn't enough money to go around. So they had to let the cook go. And Tom, who didn't know very much, I mean, Tom, who pretended to know a little bit about everything, became, not only became the gardener and the servant, the manservant, but he became the cook. And Ernestine had to help him learn how to cook. Okay. I'll just let you read what's here. I don't need to actually say it. She is the co-author of the book Cheaper by the Dozen and Bells on Their Toes. And I want you to see the way that that is bells, meaning young women who had to be on their toes to catch men. This was not about ding-a-ding-a-ling bells on their footwear. Translated into numerous languages. This is French. I think, I don't remember what this language is. And this is the title of Cheaper by the Dozen in Finnish. I don't know, does anybody know how to pronounce that? What is also interesting, and as Jane said, I love everything about Montclair. The first edition of both Cheaper by the Dozen and Bells on Their Toes was finished by the Crowell Publishing Company. And Thomas Crowell lived on Park Street in Montclair, the publisher. These are some of the other books that Ernestine wrote. She kind of became the family archivist, and she wrote a family newsletter. And she wrote a few other books that were not published. Passed away in 2006. Martha married Richard Talaman. Frank was always trying to teach the kids. This is Frank Sr. now. Always trying to teach the kids, always trying to get them to exercise their minds, even when they weren't sitting down with a book and studying. So at the table, he would often call out math problems, and the kids had to solve them, those problems in their heads. And she was the best at mental math. There were little rewards for the ones who had the answer correctly. She was the budget keeper. And I think I told you that just before he died, well, Frank died just before he was supposed to go to Europe for a conference on time motion study. Lillian had to honor his commitment, and she had to leave the kids. You know, this is just days after Frank died. And Martha was supposed to be the budget keeper. She was given $600, and she was supposed, that was supposed to keep them going and then be enough money for them to go up to Nantucket that summer. She was supposed to organize all the packing, and she did a spectacular job packing everybody else's stuff. She forgot to pack her own things. When Lillian came back from Europe, she had presents for everybody. She was supposed to stop in Montclair on her way back from Europe, pick up Martha's bathing suit. Martha was able to get enough other clothes in Nantucket to get by, but Mom was supposed to stop back in Montclair, pick up a bathing suit, and bring it with her to Nantucket. Well, she didn't have enough time to go to Montclair, so she bought everybody presents in Europe. And she bought toys for the kids. She bought Martha a new, very fashionable European bathing suit, which Martha was delighted at. But she bought berets for all the boys, and the boys were really happy about that. It was big in France, but it wasn't real big on Nantucket. Anyway, she bought hats for the other two older girls. They liked them, but they weren't, you know, they're kind of jealous of Martha for getting a bathing suit. Well, mom had bought bathing suits for them too. And she relented a little bit and said, okay, I'll get some pocket knives for the boys who were so disappointed that they only got berets. Frank Jr., the other co-author of Cheaper by the Dozen and Bells on Their Toes. Ernestine had a boyfriend, Al Lynch, and he was a bit self-absorbed. He was kind of, he was a college boy. He was kind of what passed for cool in those days. And the family, except for Ernestine, just didn't like him very much. So they tried to figure out a way to discourage him from coming around. There was a big party announced for their, it wasn't really an engagement party, but they had a party to introduce Ernestine and Al. And the boys cooked up a scheme to make Al very uncomfortable. They took the slide lock off the inside of the bathroom door. And when Al was in the shower, in the tub, the boys kept running in and out of the bathroom. And then Frank Jr. dressed up in one of his sister's dresses and pretended to be a girl walking into the bathroom. And this was all designed to make Al very uncomfortable. And it actually kind of worked because Al stuck around for part of the party and left and never came back. Frank Jr. was a lieutenant commander in the Navy during World War II. And then he moved down to South Carolina and he wrote for the Charleston Post and Courier under a pen name, Ashley Cooper. And he called his article Doing the Charleston. These are some of the, again, the books that he wrote. He continued writing after he wrote Cheaper by the Dozen and Bells on Their Toes. He especially loved going back to Nantucket and he wrote about Nantucket. And it's just some of the other books he wrote. Frank, with Bill and Martha, after Foolish Carriage died, they were college kids or high school kids and college, you know, college age and high school age. And they decided to beat up, buy a old car. All they could afford was this beat up old Model T with no roof. When Lillian was invited to Washington, D.C. to meet the Hoovers, she took the train and the boys took the Model T. They had two flat tires. Even though it was a beat up old model with no roof, they managed to do something to the engine to make it go fast. And they were doing 60 miles an hour when a cop stopped them. And the cop found it extremely hard to believe that these kids in this beat up old car were on their way to meet the president. Eventually they got him to believe them, but it started raining and they're in this car with no roof driving to Washington, D.C. in the pouring rain. Frank had proudly purchased what was considered a in vogue at the time, one of the a kind of light tan, wide lapel, heavy material tan coat. Mom didn't like it too much. Frank was real proud of it. Anyway, they get to Washington. Mom sees what a mess these guys are because they've been out in the rain for hours. She gets an iron from the hotel and starts pressing all their clothes. Whether it was by accident or not, she burned a hole in Frank's suit that she didn't like very much. Coincidence? I don't know. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. She managed to run out. They managed to run out and buy him a new suit, which we liked almost as much as the old suit, but it was much more conservative and much more to Mom's liking. So they met the Hoovers in, well, Frank met the Hoovers in a brand new suit. Again, some of the other books that Frank wrote. This is Bill. He also served in the Navy during World War II. The family had a practice of holding family councils. Dad was the, you know, Dad was the chairman, Mom was the vice chairman, and they would discuss issues at hand using all of the parliamentary procedure and Robert's Rules of Orders. And one day at the second council, found of the second family council, they discussed buying a rug, a dining room rug. And they discussed the pros and cons, you know, who was going to take care of it, how much it was going to afford. Mom said, you know, I was thinking about getting one for about $100. And Frank Jr. jumped in and said, well, what about 95? They voted on it. Okay, we're not going to spend more than $95 for this new rug. Well, then all of a sudden, people started wondering, well, what are we going to do with that extra $5? And it was Bill who decided that they would get a dog. That created quite a bit of confusion because Mom and Dad knew how much work a dog was going to be. The kids wanted the dog anyway. They did buy the dog. It turned out to be a terrible problem. Shed all over the place, created all kinds of havoc, bit the mailman. And, you know, typical story. And guess who ended up taking care of the dog that they didn't want in the first place? Mom and Dad ended up taking care of the dog. The kids didn't. He was a bit of a mischief maker. One time they were sitting, Frank was trying to fix something under the hood of Foolish Carriage. And Bill sat at the horn and blasted it in his father's ear while he was under the hood. And of course, he smacked his head on the hood when he jumped up. This was kind of it was mischief. And you have to realize Bill was pretty young at the time. They went to Oakland to visit Grandma and Grandpa. And the Molars had a Chinese chef. Bill, the chef was checking a cake that was in the oven. Bill snuck up behind him and pushed him into the hot oven and then started making fun of him in a fake Chinese accent. That didn't really go over too well. And the cook was burned and was pretty darn pissed. Bill used to like to climb under the dining room table, and when Frank's sister Aunt Anne visited, he would pretend to lick her. He would lick her legs and pretend to be a dog, and then run away. He would lick her legs, then back off. Eventually, Aunt Anne trapped him like a bear with like a bear trap in between her legs, and yanked him up by his hair, and said, "I knew you weren't a dog." He also tricked Tom into drinking the glass of orange juice with castor oil. Like all families, when one kid got sick, all the kids got sick. They were sick with chickenpox. Tom, who was Irish and believed he knew a little bit about everything, believed he knew a lot about everything. He believed that castor oil was a cure for everything. Nobody likes castor oil. So Tom mixed it into orange juice and started handing it out to the kids. Bill adamantly, no, I don't want this. It's castor oil. It tastes terrible. I don't want it. Don't bring it near me. So Tom decided to make a deal with him. Bill could pick whichever glass. He had two glasses filled with orange juice. Bill could pick whatever one he wanted, and Tom would drink the other one. Now, Tom tried to fool Bill by pouring a little salad oil on top of one of the glasses, and that just floated to the top. The other glass he had stirred real hard. He tried to mix the castor oil into the orange juice, and so there were only a couple little bubbles of oil on the top. Tom figured that Bill was going to go for the one with the just a little bit of oil sheen on top, you know, thinking, and then they'd be fooled by the not taking the salad oil. Well, Bill figured it out, and he took the one with the salad oil, downed it gladly, and then Tom was kind of stuck drinking the orange juice with the castor oil in it. Didn't like it very much. Bill moved to Bloomfield when he married his wife. Lillian and the remaining kids also moved there, but they moved to a different house in Bloomfield. This is little Lillian, named for her mom. When she was 8, at one of the very famous family councils, Dad offered a job to the kids, and the one who bid the lowest price could get the money. Well, Lillian was trying to save for a pair of roller skates, and she really wanted the job. So she bid 47 cents, which of course was the lowest bid, to paint the backyard fence, the back fence. Well, she was 8. It took her 10 days to paint the fence. And the older kids and the parents kept discussing, you know, they were looking out the window at her struggling to paint this fence. Should we help her? Should we not help her? Dad was adamant. No, she has to learn how to honor her commitments, so she has to finish. Well, after the 10 days was over, Lillian kind of disgustedly said, well, I'm done now. Where's my 47 cents? Dad reached into his pocket, gave her her 47 cents. But when she got to bed that night, she found a brand new pair of roller skates under her pillow. Lillian and Donald lived in Verona, but they moved back to Montclair. This is the house where they lived in Montclair, and they were married. Lillian and Donald were married for 65 years. They lived in this house on Summit Avenue where they lived when they lived in Montclair. This is Fred. He was the youngest. He is the one who, whether it was an accident or not, he let the canaries fly away. Dad hated the canaries. Dad was really happy that the canaries flew away. They pretended when they took the ferry out to the island, they came back, they took the ferry to the island. They pretended to go back and look for the canaries, but they knew they weren't going to find them. And Dad was delighted that they didn't find them. But somebody else gave them some canaries, and they had to go out and buy another cage. he was the one who was forced to eat soap after his mom spoke at Nishawane School. What had happened is her mom gave a presentation for the PTA, and she talked a little bit about their business and time motion study and efficiency. And Frank Jr. Senior used to boast how he would use to save time when he shaved, he would lather up his face with 2 shaving brushes. Save time. Well, the word got back to an older kid, a bully, and he cornered Fred and gave him a bar of soap and said, show me how your dad did this. How does he do this with two shaving brushes? And what he was really trying to do was shove that soap in Fred's mouth. Well, Lillian came on the scene and she whacked his assailant with her brand new roller skate. And Fred became an IBM engineer. He married Jesse Talman, who was the sister of Martha's husband, Richard. And he was the last of the dozen. Here's Dan. He started an importing business based in Montclair. I believe that the business was located in the building that now houses the Williams Sonoma. It was in the Upper Montclair Shopping Center. I'm not totally sure it was in that building, but that's where I believe his business was. He was also married for 65 years, and he was a deacon at the First Congregational Church. His claim to fame was when he was young, but old enough to start buying presents for the other kids. He decided to go downtown. They let him go downtown all by himself, and he got everybody a great big, ugly ashtray for Christmas. He went out and got 11 big, ugly ashtrays, and of course, was not very well received by the family. This is their home in Montclair on Highland Avenue. He also loved Nantucket. He used to fish and would bring the excess fish to a senior citizen's home in Nantucket. This is John or Jack. I believe you said that was your father, Peter. He became an engineer. He was the one who produced a massive burp at the family dinner table when they had a guest, and he tried to blame it on the guest. And this is their home on Fernwood Avenue in Montclair. Where you grew up, Peter? Yeah. This is Bob.
Sorry about that. Yes,
Well, you shook your head. he was the one who jumped on the train of Anne's wedding dress and held up the procession. And it was his baby at the christening who reminded everybody of Frank Sr. Now, Frank Sr. didn't like going to church that much. He would go for christenings, he would go for Christmas, he would go for Easter, but basically he didn't like going to church that much, and church made him squirm a little bit, just like the little baby at the baptism. So that's why he reminded everybody of, why the baby reminded everybody of Frank Sr. Frank used to love to, he thought, although he didn't want to go to church that often himself, he did think it was important that the kids all went to Sunday school. So he would drive mom and all the kids to Sunday school, and then he would sit in the car reading the paper while they were in on Sunday school. And this was their church. They went to First Congregational on South Park Street. Fullerton, sorry. South Fullerton. He lived in New Hampshire, became a teacher, was elected to the New Hampshire State Legislature. Jump back to Bob and Barbara. They ran a B&B in Nantucket called the Anchor Inn. That really was what Frank Jr.'s book Inside Nantucket was all about their adventures and misadventures running the B&B. This is Jane. She met her husband at Montclair High School. When the boys were a little bit older, they had some experience. They decided to teach Jane how to act in a way that would attract boys. So they taught her how to flounce her dress when she sat down, and they taught her how to smoothly exchange partners at a dance. She was also the one who slapped Ned Morris when he tried to kiss her. And she opened a restaurant in California. I went through the two books, Cheaper by the Dozen and Bells on Their Toes, and tried to figure out who the characters were. Tom, who we've talked about a few times and was really featured quite heavily in the two books. His name was Tom Greaves. Oops. And that was his real name, Tom Greaves. They had a cook before Frank Sr. died, Mrs. Cunningham, and that was her real name, Agnes Cunningham. After Tom became sick, Lillian hired an energetic colored woman. She never named her. That, of course, was not her name, but her real name was Rebecca Ginns. I did find that information in the census. Mrs. Bruce was a neighbor of hers who had 8 kids. That was not really her name. Her name was Catherine Hughes. Dr. Burton, who also appeared several times. There was no Dr. Burton in Montclair. However, there was a Dr. Butler. The principal at Nishawane, in the book, she's called Mrs. Bilsop. Her real name was Clara Gilnack. She was a real person. These are other people from the books who I couldn't find out who they were. Now, I couldn't find out who Mr. Conway was. Mr. Cogan. It's kind of an interesting story. There was a Cogan who lived in, of Cogan who was a photographer who lived in Bloomfield. Couldn't find one in Montclair. The interesting story about Mr. Cogan, it's an interesting story about a lot of things. This is back when Frank was still alive. He filmed everything to study it carefully. Ernestine had to have her tonsils out. So Frank, being the efficiency expert he was, said, well, let's have all the kids get their tonsils out, at least the older kids. And he decided he was going to film it and study it so that he could figure out the best way to perform the operation. Mr. Cogan was assigned the job of filming this thing. You know, it wasn't all the kids, but I think 5 or 6 kids got their tonsils taken out all at the same time. This disturbed Mr. Cogan a lot. He kept getting, wanting to throw up. He didn't like watching operations, but Frank Sr. kept, bugging him. Keep filming. Don't stop. Don't leave. Keep filming. Well, it turned out that Mr. Cogan accidentally left the internal lens cap on the camera. And after all that pushing, Frank kept waiting to see the film so he could study it. And there was no film. It all was blank. Mr. Kogan quit. That's how he told Frank Sr., you know, the news, the sad news about the fact that they had not filmed any of the tonsillectomies. And it was typical, you know, he can't quit, I fire him. So that's the way that ended. After Frank passed away, Lillian hired a stenographer to help put her ideas on paper. And there was a Nellie Butler, who was a stenographer who lived in Montclair. Lillian passed away in 1972. After the kids moved out, she lived on this in this apartment on the Crescent. And this is just kind of a family tree of their kids and their grandkids. Sorry. And this is Den's son, David, and Bill's daughter, Lillian, in the Montclair Library. Lillian, the mom, actually was also very, besides being active in all the things that she was active in, Girl Scouts, engineering, mom, you know, being a mom, she was also pretty active in the Montclair Public Library. And that, my friends, is it.
Thank you, Mike. We had some spirited discussion in the chat.
Did you?
Today, yes, including the question as to whether Peter still has a beret.
Never had the pleasure.
Never got the beret. It didn't get handed down.
Well, his dad would have had the beret.
Mike, would you stop sharing your screen?
Sure.
Thank you. Lots of discussion about whether or not the second film was as good as the first film. There was discussion about some of the different people. But if anybody has any questions, please raise them. Mm-hmm. I know we're late a little bit. We're 4 minutes over. So if you've got anything and can hang on, that's great. Mike can be here and answer any questions you might have.
Well, I know in Cheaper by the Dozen, which really focused mostly on Frank Sr. Now, the book does focus on Frank Sr., the book Cheaper by the Dozen. But actually, at the time Cheaper by the Dozen was filmed, I've forgotten the name of the actor. The actor was that?
Clifton Webb.
Clifton Webb, thank you. Thank you very much. Clifton Webb was more popular than Myrna Loy. So, of course, he became the focus of the film. But really, if you know anything about the family, Lillian, the mom, she was the dynamic engine behind everything.
Thank you so much for this. It was a wonderful program. You know what? I don't know if you can do it, but you had to go by the slide of her kitchen design so quickly. Is it possible to retrieve that? Not the triangular kitchen, but the one that she suggested in its place.
Well, I have to share my screen again to do that and go back a little bit. I can do that, but I don't know if we have time for that.
If there are any other questions first?
I'm sorry, Carol.
At the very end, Carol, if that works for you. Peter, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Well, I thought I knew a lot about my family background, but it's really amazing how much more I learned with photographs I had not seen before.
Wow.
And some stories. But what I will say, it was 100% accurate, your presentation about what I did know. But just quickly about the movie, the whole story was that our generation was very upset with Steve Martin, Cheaper by the Dozen.
Oh, yeah.
Although personally, I think Steve Martin's hilarious, but it really was not reflective of what Myrna Loy and Clifton Webb were all about. So that's really the comment on the movie. But I was lucky. I grew up in Montclair and got to meet so much of my aunts and uncles and my grandmother, we called her Grand Deer. Because she lived in New York and then in Montclair. So those are special days. And that's why I'm glad I joined in today. My wife is sitting next to me and my daughter is here in Pennsylvania and she's been listening in. So we appreciated the presentation.
Well, thank you.
Why don't, Mike, you can go back and share your screen and go back to that one thing that Carol has asked for.
I have a fantasy question. All my life, when I was reading the books over and over, I always wanted to get inside the houses. So, I mean, and you just went by the slide. It's the
no, next, right there. I thought it was the next one.
One after the kitchen practical.
Right. Next one, Mike.
Does anybody anywhere have like a floor plan of the house on Eagle Rock Way? I always wanted to get into that house.
I can't remember when
it was torn down. And I was reading the books in the mid-50s. I think Bells on Their Toes was actually a book of the month club. And I just read it every week. You know, I just adored it. But I don't know when the house was torn down. And I bet it was still there.
I believe it was torn down in the early 40s after she
sold it. Oh, really?
Or at the time she sold it. It was in pretty bad condition. I couldn't swear to this, but that's what I remember.
I would imagine raising 12 kids would wreak havoc on any home.
Yeah, it would apparently was not in the world's best condition when they got it in 20 no. years of their inhabit. Almost a dozen kids floating around and all the stuff they were doing there sounds like it. And they never had a lot of money. I mean, by 1924, after Frank's death, they didn't have the money to do the maintenance that would have been required on this mansion to keep.
Well, this is a wonderful setup for a kitchen. Don't you love the planning desk?
I mean, she's not talking about 21 feet between the appliances. She basically is standing still and can reach almost standing still and reach everything from where she is.
What I loved was somebody in the comments section said that they can't imagine everything on wheels. That must have been quite daring with all those kids running around.
Yeah.
Oh, well, apparently, not in that kitchen, first of all.
This is a hypothetical kitchen. This is not her kitchen.
Her kitchen in her house
was set up in the 1890s for when people had multiple servants. So actually you wanted a bigger kitchen and more space between things so that all the first servants had room to work. In around 1930, after the word started getting out about how she designed her kitchens and wanted to design her kitchen, the word got out and a film crew wanted to come and film her kitchen in her house. And her kitchen or her house, remember Tom was the cook at that time. So Tom had the kitchen set up the way he wanted it. She had a concept for a new kitchen and a more efficient kitchen, but her kitchen actually in her house didn't actually really look like that. So just before the film crew showed up, she had to start rearranging furniture in the kitchen to be more like her concept. Tom walked in on the middle of the filming, was very upset that somebody was fooling around with his kitchen. And then in the middle of filming, a cat jumped off one of the cabinets and onto Lillian's back. And she threw the milk and the eggs up in the air and pretty much that disrupted the filming completely. So they ended up having to clean up the mess, kind of sheepishly finish whatever filming they could finish, and then very dutifully put everything back in the way that Tom wanted it to be.
Well, thank you, Mike. This has been great and pretty high praise when you learn that a grandson actually learned a lot from the program as well. So congratulations on that.
Yeah, this was terrific, Mike. I'd done a lot of research and I learned a lot of stuff too. I want to thank you. And I just want to invite people who want to learn more. I do a program called Mothers of Invention and I do it in the persona of Lillian.
Ah. And
I've got a lot of programs, a number of them virtual for Women's History Month in March. And if you go to my website, I put it in the link, you can find where the performances are happening if anybody wants to jump and learn more. And I also prepared a bibliography on Lillian and on inventive women and innovative women.
And it's a pretty sizable bibliography.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of material out there if people are interested.
Well, thank you all, and hope to see you again in 2 weeks. Take care, everybody.
Thanks, Mike. Great job.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Terrific job. And thanks, Jane, for organizing all of these.
Thank you, Carol. Glad you're on again.
Mm-hmm.